From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
Black folks don't understand the connectedness with this, the whole issue of support of black media. As I said earlier, that's why we don't have any black daily newspapers. As many affluent black folks as we have now, as many intelligent people, as many highly educated people, we could support a black newspaper, a daily. But guess what? There's not enough advertising revenue allocated for black-owned media because, you know, why would you advertise with me? My number one show on TV One is Unsung. Why would you put advertising dollars in Unsung when you're going to get them black folks over there watching Empire with Fox? And plus, your cousin runs Fox. Okay, white folks look out for white folks. Black folks have been brainwashed into not doing business with each other and not looking out for each other. And it's tragic. I pray that this generation disease and the millennials and all the young people who are out there protesting every day now, I hope that part of what will change is the support of black folks, of other black folks in business.
Kathy Hughes, founder and chairwoman of Urban One Incorporated, the largest African-American owned and operated media company in America. Hughes began a broadcasting career in her hometown of Omaha, Nebraska, at KOWH-AM, a station owned by a group of African-American professionals. In 1971, she moved to the nation's capital and became a lecturer in the newly established School of Communications at Howard University. In 1980, she purchased the first radio station, WOL-AM, in Washington, D.C., where she served as the station's morning show host for 11 years. Along with her son Alfred, who is now her business partner, they have now grown what was once Radio One into a multimedia company that includes 54 radio stations, syndicated radio programming, cable television, and online digital media. I'm Johnny O. Henson Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Kathy Hughes, founder and chairwoman of Urban One Incorporated, Part 2, In Black America.
I come from generations of entrepreneurs, and so I just assumed the same way. I didn't have a choice. I was typing 100 words a minute, and back then we did shorthand. I was doing shorthand at 110 words a minute before I was 12 years old. So I just assumed that it was my son's responsibility to help me run my business the same way it was my responsibility to help both my grandfather and my father run their businesses. And I was so very proud when he decided on his own that he wanted to be part of the company, and he also wanted to take it to the next level, because oftentimes when you have that type of mentality that you just assume that, you know, your children and grandchildren are going to work in the business that you set up, they don't always go for that. They want to do their own thing. And, you know, one of the happiest days of my life was when, because at first he told me he was going to work for me only 2 years, and then he was going to go do his own thing. Then it became 3 years, and it became 5 years.
Urban One Incorporated is the parent company of Radio One, TV One, Cleo TV, iOne Digital, One Solution, and Reach Media Incorporated, which includes BlackAmericaWeb.com, making it the largest African-American owned and operated media company in America. Founded by Kathy Hughes in 1980, Radio One was renamed Urban One Incorporated to better reflect the company's multimedia operations. Hughes' love for radio began when her mother gave her a transistor radio when she was 8 years old. That love grew stronger when a group of African-American professionals purchased a radio station in her hometown of Omaha, Nebraska. Hughes is truly a trailblazer. In 1999, she became the first African-American woman to chair a publicly held corporation. Over the course of her career, Hughes has been a mentor to countless women and an advocate dedicated to empowering minority communities. On today's program, we conclude our conversation with Kathy Hughes.
88% of everyone that we sent this survey out to responded, yes, please, do it, do it. Howard University didn't want to do it. They were reluctant. I was quite a controversial general manager because Howard's radio station had historically only played jazz.
Right.
And unfortunately, the student body was not listening to the station, nor was the general audience. So I changed the format. So it was pretty controversial because once I took jazz off and put on a different format, gospel on Sunday, the Quiet Storm in the evening, popular music during the day, I had demonstrations outside that radio station. So when I brought my latest idea to Howard, which would have been, if Howard University had done two things, they would be self-sustaining today. The first thing I tried to get them to do was the black music. The second thing, because also part of that poll that we did, that survey that we did, determining whether or not black professionals would be willing we even expanded it past doctors and lawyers and dentists, and we included beauty parlors and barbershops and black businesses in general. But the second thing that they refused to do, because as I said, I was pretty provocative as their general manager, was they refused to license the Quiet Storm. If they had licensed the Quiet Storm and allowed me to actually create a black music, to this day, they would not be having to accept money from the federal government. Most people don't realize that Howard University is not a historically black university of college. They're not an HBCU. They are what is called a land-grant college. They get direct funding, just like the Department of Energy, the Federal Trade Commission. They get funding directly from the federal government. They are a land-grant college, not a historically black college or university. If they had allowed me to do those two things for them while I was there, they would be self-sustaining today, because those two ideas have literally generated billions and billions and billions of dollars.
What led you to your second entree into radio ownership?
What do you mean my second?
Well, you said you was in Omaha, so you started at the top.
Oh, yes, I was an investor. Okay. I wasn't really an owner. I was an investor.
Investor, okay.
Yeah, the fact that Howard wouldn't would not copyright the Quiet Storm format and would not let me do the black music, really, I felt they were throwing out the baby with the bathwater, and I wanted to work for myself. So the next time God blessed me with a billion-dollar idea, I would not have to go any higher than God to get it, get a green light for it, get it approved. I had watched them literally turn their backs on two very lucrative financial opportunities. And I was like, no, I can't do this a third time. And so that's what led me to go into business for myself and become an owner. In becoming an investor and an owner in terms of bottom line responsibility, as an investor in Omaha and KOWH, the bottom line responsibility was not mine. Once I became an owner in 1980 with my first radio station in D.C., WOL, that bottom line responsibility was totally on me. Big difference between being an owner and being an investor.
As I was going to state, speaking of babies, during this period, you had a child and you were working at the radio station.
Mama raising a son by myself who has for the last couple decades been my CEO and used to facetiously say that he thought that everybody went to a radio station after school because that's what he did all through elementary school. He would come to the radio station. I'm in a city. I don't know anyone. I don't have any family here. And I was not entrusting the rearing of my only child. I had become a parent before I had reached legal age of voting or drinking. Okay, I was, a mama, pregnant at 16, a mama at 17. And so I kept him very close to me. So my system was I brought him to the radio station every day after school, picked him up, brought him in, cooked dinner for the week on the weekends before, brought our dinner. We would have dinner, then we did our homework. And if it was going to be a late night at the radio station, to put him in a sleeping bag, let him go to sleep, then we'd carry him to the car and take him home. If it was something we had to go to, I used to stay in trouble because, Howard University was not accustomed to, anybody bringing a young child to various events, but I was not going to entrust him to somebody I didn't know. So he had his first tuxedo when he was about 7 years old, because if we had something to do that evening, a fundraiser or some type of, you know, event, industry event, trade, you know, association event, or, you know, Chamber of Commerce, I put on my, you know, after five and put him in a tuxedo, and he was my date. I took him everywhere with me.
When you go to look at purchasing radio stations or other media facilities, what are some of the things that you're looking for? What are some of the objectives that you have in mind?
First thing that I'm looking at is what type of advertising revenue is coming into the market where the station is located. It is so very difficult for black people in media. The reason we don't have a daily newspaper is because our weeklies can't get enough revenue to grow into a daily. It is, even though we're the largest, it's such a uphill battle. As soon as COVID-19 hit, I lost 62% of my revenue. The advertising dollars that are allocated to media annually, black folks, black-owned media receives about 3%. Of the billions and billions and billions of dollars that's spent on advertising. And it is such a difficult struggle for a black business, period, to, you know, and when I went into, for instance, cable, it was just BET and TV1. Now Fox owns a black network, Comcast. Everyone is in the black people business, and unfortunately, black consumers have not learned yet. One of the benefits of segregation was that we were forced to do business with each other. Consequently, mm-hmm. we built some very successful businesses. Black Wall Street, Tulsa, Oklahoma was successful because those black folks did business with each other. They built that economy to the point where it was considered a black Wall Street. Well, when integration came, black folks figured that, you know, one of my pet lectures to black folks is, you all want to complain and talk about how much you hate Fox News, and yet the television show Empire was for many years, not any longer, but for many years, the number one watched television show in America was Empire. The same people who own Fox News owned Empire. I said, so you're complaining about, you hate Fox News, they're so, you know, anti-black, but yet you give them your support by watching Empire every week. So they use the money they make off you all on Empire and then talk about you like a dog on Fox News. Black folks don't understand the connectiveness with this, of the whole issue of support of black media. As I said earlier, that's why we don't have any black daily newspapers. As many affluent black folks as we have now, as many intelligent people, as many highly educated people, we could support a black newspaper, a daily. But guess what? There's not enough advertising revenue allocated for black-owned media because, you know, why would you advertise with me? My number one show on TV1 is Unsung. Why would you put advertising dollars in Unsung when you're going to get them black folks over there watching Empire with Fox? And plus, your cousin runs Fox. Okay, white folks look out for white folks. Black folks have been brainwashed into not doing business with each other and not looking out for each other, and it's tragic. I pray that this generation, the Z's and the millennials and all the young people who are out there protesting every day now, I hope that part of what will change is the support of black folks, of other black folks in business.
Talk to us about Reach Media.
Reach Media was a company founded by David Cantor and Tom Joyner. David Cantor was the president of the radio division of ABC Radio, and Tom Joyner came to him with an idea of syndicating his show. First, Tom was called the Fly Jock because he would actually fly between Chicago and Dallas every day.
Right.
He would do the morning show in one city and the afternoon show in another. So he had this idea, how about syndication? And so David Cantor left the network, and he and Tom started a company called Reach Media. Tom's father, Hercules Joyner, was one of the Tuskegee Airmen, a wonderful human being. And he was a big, big fan. At that time, I was the host of my morning show on WOL because I couldn't afford to pay talk show hosts, so I kind of did it myself. And Hercules used to listen to my show. And so one day he and I are somewhere, and we're conversing, and he says, "You know how powerful it would be if my son and you all were combined?" And I said, "Oh, I've thought about that a lot." Because at one time, the same people who gave me my first financing to buy my first radio station, also the same week, I'm 40 years old this year. BET is 40 years old this year. They gave Bob Johnson the money to start BET. And they had the idea, what if we combine Radio 1 and BET? Well, Bob Johnson and Deborah Lee didn't want to hear that. They said that they would be willing to absorb us into the company, but they weren't willing to do a 50-50 partnership with us. Well, Tom Joyner, with the advice of his father and David Cantor, decided to partner with us. And so Radio 1 bought Reach Media and started Syndication 1. And after maybe less than a year of realizing that we had it in reverse, that Reach Media and Tom Joyner's company was much better at syndication. We were good at local market radio. They were much better at syndication. So Reach Media actually runs my radio division, Radio 1 now.
I understand.
We'll be back with more in Black America after this message. And now back to this episode of In Black America.
A couple more questions, Ms. Yu. What has it meant to you having your son as part of building the empire that you all have thus far?
I come from generational responsibility. My grandfather in 1909 started a school called Piney Woods Country Life School in Piney Woods, Mississippi, still in operation today. Only one of three black boarding schools left. Most people don't realize at one time there were over 40 black boarding schools in America, and they were supported by the rich white families that the black folks were working for, and they sent these children, most black domestics were smart enough to say, "Listen, you know, if I'm going to have to be here around the clock at your house, you know, I need some provision to help me educate my children." So these boarding schools were very, very, very plentiful at one time in American history. But my grandfather ran a business in the, arena of education that still, you know, is now 114 years old and still going strong. My daddy had Woods Accounting Service. You know, we didn't work directly for the Nation of Islam. We had a contract. We were their accounting firm. And so I come from generations of entrepreneurs. And so I just assumed the same way. I didn't have a choice. I was typing 100 words a minute, and back then we did shorthand. I was doing shorthand at 110 words a minute before I was 12 years old. So I just assumed that it was my son's responsibility to help me run my business the same way it was my responsibility to help both my grandfather and my father run their businesses. And I was so, so, so very proud when he decided on his own that he wanted to be part of the company, and he also wanted to take it to the next level. Because oftentimes when you have that type of mentality that you just assume that, you know, your children and grandchildren are going to work in the business that you set up, they don't always go for that. They want to do their own thing. And, you know, one of the happiest days of my life was when, because at first he told me he was going to work for me only 2 years, and then he was going to go do his own thing. Then it became 3 years, and it became 5 years. And then one day he came to me and told me a fib. He told me that he needed the title of president of the company because there was an organization called the Young Presidents, and it was comprised of business executives, and it would be good for our business if he could join this organization, but he'd have to have the title of president. And so it didn't matter to me. Both he and I were working like, you know, you know, slaves to keep our business going. So it was fine. You want to be president, you can have the title. My son to this day has never joined that organization. Okay, it was strictly, but he came to me and he said, I'm going to stay, Mama. I'm going to stay and I'm going to help you build this into something bigger than even what you had described to me as I was growing up. And he's done exactly that. After he got his MBA from Wharton, he's the one who took us public. He's the one that said that radio is going to have competition from satellite and other industries. We need to diversify into cable. It was him who decided that we would set up these five other companies. It was Alfred who decided 4 years ago now that we would diversify and do a partnership with MGM. We own part of the casino here in the metropolitan area in D.C., and we invested in the MGM. We were the first time that they've ever allowed a real investor. They've done minor investments. They've like let black folks put $100,000 here or there, but we were the first major investor. We own 10% of the casino here in the Washington area, and nearly 10%. It's not quite 10, but he's the one that said we're either going to have to grow or go, and we don't want to go. So we want to grow, Mama, so we're going to have to diversify. And the reason we went into gaming and the reason we went into casinos is casinos spend billions of dollars advertising each year. So part of our investment was tied into a return of a guaranteed advertising relationship with us as an investor. That was the only way, the main reason we wanted to invest to guarantee that advertising revenue. So, you know, our largest client. And so it's been a joy. It's been a struggle also. It's very difficult to relinquish responsibility to the same youngster who used to lose the keys to the front door to the house. Okay? And so you're like, if I give you the combination to the safe, okay, are you going to lose the safe and what's in it? And so, and I have, as you probably have deducted from this interview with me, I have a very forceful personality. I'm very passionate about my life, about my career, about my blessings from God. And so it was very, very difficult for me to understand that, you know, you can't have a two-headed leader. Okay, one of us had to be a real president, or one of us had to be a real CEO, and the other one would have to take a different job. And I'm glad that we were finally able to work through it. And many years ago, he became the head of our corporation, and I became, I start filling a lesser role that's, in my opinion, a lot more important than even running the company, which is I am the link to the community. I am the community activist in the company. I run the board, and I also run our community relations division, as well as still sell airtime, because as I said, it is so difficult to get advertising. It's so difficult to convince, you know, a major advertiser like a Walmart that, yes, you may be able to get black people watching Empire or listening to iHeartRadio, but there's a difference between reaching black folks and touching black folks. And I just don't sell you numbers. I'm just not bringing you eyeballs or ears. I'm bringing you heart. I am bringing you an emotional attachment that black radio to this day still ranks number two with black consumers, second only to the black church in terms of credibility, believability, and trust from a black consumer.
Before I let you go, Ms. Yu, talk to us about Black History 365.
Oh, Black History 365. There's a gentleman named Dr. Joel Freeman. Dr. Joel Freeman has, on his own, collected so much black historical archives, artifacts, memorabilia. Oh, my goodness, such an expert. And he's a Jewish gentleman. He partnered with a brother who was superintendent of a school system and said, you know, this black history teaching occurring only in February is for the birds. Black history needs to be taught 365 days a year. And together, these two geniuses developed a curriculum that has been accepted by the Dallas school system. Dallas has some legislation that says Black history needs to be taught throughout the year, through the entire school year, which is very interesting coming out of Texas, because also part of that is the Bush family saying that they agreed that Black history should not just be relegated. So this 365 curriculum is something that will allow all school children, and we hope nationwide, we pray nationwide, all school children will have an opportunity. If I could just, go on a little sidebar for a moment. You know, this whole issue now that's going on with the protest movement in terms of these Confederate monuments coming down and things being named after, you know, just overt white supremacists, in Germany, after Hitler, the Nazis, there are no statues, you know, celebrating any Nazis anywhere in the entire country of Germany. Every single solitary child in Germany in the school system has to go to the concentration camp, has to see the gas chambers. It's part of the requirement. It's how they change the mentality of Nazism. That's what has to happen in this country. That's exactly why 365 curriculum is so important, because this isn't something that you can just touch upon. Most white kids, and unfortunately too many Black kids, know who Martin Luther King is, have no idea who other people are, because they're not being taught it. So when they're asked to do a paper during Black History Month, it's always, okay, on Dr. King. There are millions of stories out there that have never been told to school children, and that's what 365, the curriculum, does. It teaches young people. That's how you change. That's how you dismantle systemic racism. That's how you eliminate institutional racism. You change the minds of young people. And that can only be done as a teaching tool in the school system. So I thank God to these two wonderful brothers who have put together this curriculum and now are pitching it to school systems around the country. And it looks like they may have their second school system again in Dallas. But I'm prayerful that every major school system in America will embrace this. That's how we change this country, and that's how we provide equality and equity for people of color.
Kathy Hughes, founder and chairwoman of Urban One Incorporated, the largest African-American owned and operated media company in America. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.